Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 298 for January 16th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
My first impression is, oh my God, what a rundown facility this was. But then you could also see the potential. It just had a certain air about it.
That's Dave Shurick, who officially retired a couple of weeks ago as the distillery manager at Woodford Reserve. He was responsible for bringing the old LeBrow & Graham distillery back to life after two decades of neglect. He'll share his stories with us later on. His wife, Della, will join us as well. That's coming up along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by the folks at Glenmorangie. Shackleton's whiskey is headed home. According to an Australian newspaper, White & Mackay owner Dr. V.J. Malia and master blender Richard Patterson have left Christchurch, New Zealand, with three full bottles of the 115-year-old McKinley's blended scotch that was abandoned in Antarctica by explorer Ernest Shackleton back in 1907. White & Mackay has not commented on the report yet. However, reliable sources tell me the two are still in transit back to Scotland. Expect some type of confirmation early this week. Maker's Mark President Bill Samuels Jr. announced his plans to step down after 35 years of running the company. Bill will become Chairman Emeritus, while his son, Rob Samuels, will take over day-to-day management and keep the title of Chief Operating Officer. I talked with Bill after the announcement, and he says it's time.
I'll be 71 this summer. We brought my son in 5 years ago, hoping that he could be the next leader without any promises, and he certainly lived up to all we expected. And I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about the good people at Beam and our other members of the senior team. And I'd let everybody know that I was going to leave in about 9 or 10 months anyway, and give the younger people a chance to run the business. And so it's really only about 3 or 4 months early, and than I thought it, but it was just perfect. We had come through a great year. I like the idea of going out a winner and leaving the business better than I found it, and they were all chomping at the bit to pick up the yoke and go. So, and also, I'm just moving to the back of the bus. Everybody recognized that I'm a workaholic by nature. So they're going to give me a small office in the closet, and I still get my allotment of adult beverage, and I'll help them wherever I can. I do a lot of travel for the company. I really like that. I love hanging out with our customers. That's something I've always enjoyed. We have always depended on our customers to tell their friends to sort of make up for the fact that my marketing wasn't all that great, and all of that will continue. It's just I won't have to go to any meetings, go to a few more basketball games, spend a little more time with the grandchildren, and actually go on vacation,
which is something you really haven't done for a while, right?
No, I have in the last 5 years, but before that I bet I didn't average 3 days off a year. And it wasn't the pressure. Just there hadn't been any bad days. It's just been fun.
Now, you admitted to being a workaholic. Are you going to be able to actually step back and stay away from the office?
Well, I still have an office here. I think so. I've had a lot of discussions. We've got some people that we work with, industrial psychologists who are very familiar with my driving approach to life. And I think so. I've developed a few hobbies, but I've still managed to stay engaged in the community. I've, I'm on a number of boards. Chair Bellarmine University Capital Campaign. We're trying to get these damn bridges built down here, and that's about a half a full-time job in itself.
What is Rob going to bring as the COO to this company going forward?
Well, let me, just in contrast, what he's going to bring is when I started, one of the things my father did was to engage a firm that did did analysis, personality analysis and all. And they came to me and after the, with the results, and they said, don't let the company get too big because you won't be able to manage it. And I never forgot that. Clearly my strength is not in managing. It's in creative leadership. And I'll still be able to provide some of that juice. Rob is a much, much better manager than I am. Much, much. It's not even close. And I think everybody around here recognizes that, and they're really fired up about his coming into the business at a time when we've just exceeded 1 million cases. So it's becoming a force in the industry. And as our international growth just has exploded, as I think it has for a number of the other companies. So I think the main thing, his style of leadership will be more professional. He is exactly the age demographic as our customers. He's 36. When I started, the average age of our customers were between 55 and 60, and I was 27. And now I'm 70, and they're about 34. So as I was getting older, customers were getting younger, and and I certainly don't think I have any trouble in engaging with our customers, but the age gap is dramatic. And so I really need to be supporting a team rather than leading a team going to market.
Now, I have to ask this question, and feel free to defer it if you don't want to answer, but this comes at a time when the company is in, when Beam Global is in a certain amount of play because of decisions that have been made on the parent company, Fortune Brands. Did any of that come into play in your decision here?
No. The when Beam bought the Allied products, about 5.5 years ago, we had about 3 or 4 months of delay because of FTC issues, monopoly. And the president of Beam came down. First thing I said to him is, he said, how much time are you willing to give us? And I said, I'll go 6 years. And so that's, you know, that was going to be the end anyway, and that was public knowledge, and I just backed it up 6 months. But it was really decided back 3 or 4 months before any of this business about Fortune becoming a spirits-only company. Personally, I think that's a good thing. And I believe with this leadership team they've got, Matt Shattuck down, they've got a fair chance of making it work.
Now, the other question I've got for you is one that didn't get a lot of play, but your going-away party is actually going to be a real going-away party of sorts at Thoroughbreds and Redheads weekend, right?
Yes. We about halfway misspoke that. This is going to be the final Thoroughbreds and Redheads ambassador event in that form. There will be others. We just haven't created them yet. Okay. We've had several calls from Lexington folks. Oh, does this mean the end of the Maker's Mark Mile? Does it mean the end of the commemorative bottle we do to raise charity? The answer is no and no. It's just we wanted, or it wasn't me, it was Rob and the other folks said, we ought to mix this up. We do a lot better when we change things around and surprise people. And so next April or sometime, we will have an ambassador event, but we don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be different than the one we're going to have this year. So that's when the girl said, why don't you let us do your retirement party with your customers? And I said, I can't think of anything I'd rather do.
So the ambassadors are already getting information on how they can order tickets for this final Thoroughbreds and Redheads ambassador party, which
That's correct.
Be a pretty good blowout from what I gather.
That went out this morning. I suspect it will, and I will have had some sleep before to get ready for it. But no, it's just super. It's one of the things that I really enjoy more than anything, especially the party we have after the race. We'll have about 4,000, 4,500 ambassadors come from all over the country.
Now, after 35 years, is there anything that you'd do differently?
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing I would have done differently, but it goes back more than 35 years. It goes back to when I started. If I could have moderated my hard head, it wouldn't have taken 52 years to get where we are right now. But I was so sure, this is the truth, I was so sure that my father, while acknowledging that he was a great whiskey man, was an ignoramus when it came to going to market. And if it hadn't been for Doe Anderson, our agency of some 40 years now, if it hadn't been for them raising the question, maybe he's right. Why don't we try listening to him? Maybe it's just because he doesn't know how to articulate what he really wants this brand to be. And it took me a good 15 years, maybe 20 years. Because I started in 67, and it was really in the early 80s that we started to figure out how we could execute Dad's vision rather than fight with him. And that's the thing that I, even to this day, I said, God almighty, if I'd have just opened my brain up about 10, 12 years earlier, yeah, we might have been farther down the road than we are right now, and we're pretty far down the road now.
Do you think you have his vision firmly in place?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not only in place, it's institutionalized. And that's one of the great benefits of my son coming in, because he brings all the management skills, and he spent a lot of time with his grandfather. He spent a lot of time with me. He knows the brand better than anybody. He knows the important stuff, the soft stuff, the touch, the feel, the tone, and it's just second nature with him. And not just him, but the other members of the team too. We've got kind of, you know, a little different way of doing business. We don't like to get up in people's face. We like to have fun, and we like to focus as much of the conversation as we can on what we do at the distillery.
When you're still going to be around the distillery from time to time, I would assume.
Oh yeah, I'm going to be around. I don't know exactly. It's up to him. I do know I'm moving out of my office to send a symbol, and they're going to find me a closet, a broom closet somewhere, which is fine, as long as I get my phone and computer. But I'll be available. This will be a very easy transition. It's already well underway. And like I said, there's a whole lot of the folks that find him already better than I was at my peak.
Now, Bill mentioned more global interest in bourbon, and a new report from the organizers of VinExpo shows just how much that interest is growing. Bourbon sales in the UK, the home of Scotch whiskey, rose 25% between 2005 and 2009, according to IWSR sales data, and bourbon sales are expected to grow by another 22% between 2009 and 2014. That means bourbon would grow at a rate twice that of any other spirits category in the UK. Last time around, I mentioned the debut of Early Times 354, the first bourbon to carry the Early Times label in the U.S. in about 30 years. Early Times has always been sold as a bourbon in export markets, and I talked with Brown-Forman master distiller Chris Morris this week about the decision to bring back an Early Times bourbon in the States.
The prompting to bring Early Times back as a bourbon was simply demand. Lots of people asking for it. Key retailers, some key distributors, and customers. And especially if you're in Kentucky, where people know bourbon and they know Early Times is being sold in New Zealand as bourbon, and you know, why can't we have it back? And I would really credit the fact that bourbon is popular again in demand and exciting as a category as the impetus to bring Early Times back as a straight bourbon whiskey in the States.
Will it replace the Kentucky whiskey or be marketed alongside the Kentucky whiskey?
It will not replace Kentucky whiskey. Early Times whiskey, Early Times bourbon will be marketed side by side because they do have really different flavor profiles. And as an expert, you know, they taste very much the same, but they present their style differently. And the price point will be significantly different, up to $4 or $5 a bottle difference. So each one should have its own consumer base because we do know people shop on price as well as flavor profile. And it's had such a great following. It's still a number five selling American spirit since the 1950s. So it is a healthy brand, and we will keep it going.
And it's been a healthy brand, although, to be fair, in a lot of cases, you're going to find it on the bottom shelf at a lot of stores and a lot of retailers in that with the value whiskeys. Is this a case of trying to revive this brand? Because I remember growing up in southern Indiana, and one of the things you saw Mail Pouch chewing tobacco barns, Early Times billboards, and Sea Rock City billboards all over the place. So it's one of those brands that you sort of grew up remembering, but you don't really understand the history of it when you see it down there in that little lonesome bottom shelf label, right?
No, it was and is a terrific brand, but what a terrific brand. If you take its volume at its heyday in the 50s and multiply that per capita consumption by the population of the United States then and today, it would have been larger than Jack Daniel's is today. It was a dominant whiskey, but it was in a world where there were a lot of 1 million case plus bourbons, and all of which to a brand are well below a million cap, well below. So I think its current volume is indicative of that entire old style category, all those great brands. Such as I.W. Harper. Over a million cases today. It's not even in the United States. It's long gone from the United States. So it is a value brand now, and most of the brands in that segment are. All the brands that are popular and successful today, with the exception of Jack Daniel's, are all introduced after the Second World War, introduced in the 1940s. Jim Beam introduced in 42, Makers in 59, the Knob Creeks and Woodford Reserves introduced in the 1990s. So it's really a whole a new generation that people are enjoying today. So to have a brand from 1860 still kicking around, I think is pretty impressive.
I know last year you released 150th anniversary bottling that we talked about back then, sort of went back to the Prohibition era days of Early Times when it was still being made, right?
Yes. Brown-Forman acquired the brand in 1923 during Prohibition, evidence of Brown-Forman's operations during Prohibition, moved its operations from Nelson County into Louisville and parked it at DSB 354, the old Kentucky distillery, which we had acquired and renamed eventually the Brown-Forman Distillery. And there's where the new name, the current name for the bourbon, comes from, the longest continuously operated bourbon distillery in Kentucky. It's been operated by Brown-Forman continuously since that date.
Early Times 354 will initially be available in 17 states with plans for nationwide distribution. In addition, the current export version of Early Times bourbon will be phased out in favor of Early Times 354. By the way, Chris and I were on the judging panel for Woodford Reserve's Well-Crafted Manhattan competition finals last Monday night in New York City. And since I'm not an expert bartender, I relied on Chris for some advice.
I like it simple. Keep it simple, stupid. And to me, the right balance of Woodford Reserve, vermouth, and depends on what style you're going, white, red, combination of both, and the right dash of bitters is all you need to have a great Manhattan.
11 bartenders from around the U.S. mixed their regional award-winning Manhattans, and congratulations to Marcelo Nascimento of Austin, Texas. His Voodoo Manhattan won top honors that night. His recipe is available at the Woodford Reserve website, and I've posted a link at the WhiskeyCast website. Meanwhile, Old Pulteney has selected a British Army captain to join the team of explorers hoping to be the first ever to row to the magnetic North Pole in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. 28-year-old Captain David Manns will join Jock Wishart and the other four members of the team this summer on a 450-mile trek across the Arctic. Captain Manns is a member of the Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment and commanded troops in the Middle East. He currently serves as one of the ceremonial guards at Buckingham Palace. And speaking of the palace, you might have heard something about a royal wedding of some kind planned for April. Now, several distilleries in Scotland have produced royal wedding-themed Scotch whiskies over the years, but for the first time on record, there will be an English whiskey marking a royal wedding. The English Whiskey Company plans to bottle a Prince William and Kate whiskey this spring and is taking reservations for bottles now at its website. An update now on the situation at Springbank, which has been shut down since a boiler explosion in early November. Springbank's Ronald Watson tells me the repair work is about to begin and should be finished in time to start distilling early next month. Springbank workers have been working at the Glengyle Distillery during the downtime. Of course, both distilleries are owned by J&A Mitchell & Company. Here's another update for you. Back in May, we heard from Kevin Campbell at Lagavulin about the third and final pillaged malt bottling. A team of sailors collected whiskies from Tobermory, Jura, and Ardbeg distilleries last summer and batted them together for the pillaged malt charity bottling. Online bidding was scheduled to end December 31st, but Kevin emailed to say the deadline has now been extended to the end of March. There's a link for more details at the WhiskeyCast website. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. You have just a few days left to enter Isle of Jura's Wish You Were Here travel photo competition. The entry deadline is this coming Friday, January 21st. Hugh Thompson is the latest weekly winner of an Olympus digital camera. Three grand prize winners will travel to Jura this summer with a friend for a stay at the Jura Lodge, along with an Olympus Pen digital camera and a photography masterclass with National Geographic's Jim Richardson. Remember, the deadline is this Friday, the 21st. You can find all of the details at the WhiskeyCast website. The Wish You Were Here travel photo competition is sponsored by Visit Scotland, Olympus, and Isle of Jura in a world of its own. Let's check the emails of the week now, brought to you by Highland Park. Got a great email from Tony Riccardi this week. Dear Mark, I've been listening to WhiskeyCast for the past 6 months or so and have become an instant fan of the podcast and website. Just wanted to drop you a line regarding a recent visit my wife and I made to Tuttletown Spirits Distillery in Hudson Valley, New York. My wife and I had long ago planned a weekend getaway in the Hudson Valley region of New York State and had left some free time open to enjoy some local events and sights. As my wife and I discussed where to spend our Saturday afternoon, I immediately thought of your podcast and the Tuttletown folks. I was genuinely moved by your recent news briefs regarding the health of Tuttletown partner Ralph Arenzo following his horrific car accident before Christmas. We decided to visit the distillery for a tour and tasting and show our support for Ralph and his loved ones. Cordell from Tuttletown gave us one of the most comprehensive and enjoyable tours I've ever experienced at any facility. He was engaging, funny, informative, and passionate. The entire staff at Tuttletown was friendly and approachable, and you could truly sense the feeling of family shared by the entire team. Their whiskeys were outstanding, including a wonderful rye and a baby bourbon that I would put up against any young bourbons coming out of the U.S. I encourage anyone in the Hudson Valley region to pay them a visit, sample some great whiskey, and learn a little bit about their process, their beliefs, and see firsthand what sincere passion and integrity can bring to a distillery. Our thoughts and prayers are with Ralph and his family, wishing him a speedy and thorough recovery. Thank you, Mark, for making us aware of this situation and keeping us abreast of his progress. Keep up the great work. Tony, thank you very much for that kind note. By the way, I passed the email on to Gable Lorenzo, Ralph's son, and got a quick response back. Mark, thank you so much for sharing this. Really brought a smile of pride to my face. I'm heading back in to see Dad in a minute and will share this letter with him, which I'm sure will put him at ease a bit and remind him of what he is fighting for right now. We really appreciate your support during this tough time, Mark. Thank you. Tony, thanks for showing your support and for taking the time to visit. I will certainly pass along your praise to the rest of the Tuttletown family. So glad we could be a part of your Hudson Valley experience. Come back soon. Cheers, Gable. And by the way, Ralph is still in intensive care, but is getting better day by day, and that's very good news. Also heard from Scott Mansfield in Queensland, Australia. You've probably heard about the massive flooding there this week. Scott is one of the leaders of the Queensland Malt Whiskey Society. Here's what he had to say. As a whiskey society, we gather to appreciate not only the water of life, but also good company. I and many others have formed firm friendships through the society. The flooding has affected us all in various ways. I know of members who have been isolated in cattle tour. As a father, I was deeply affected by the news of the parents in the Lockyer Valley who were swept to their deaths as they got their children onto the roof. Please let us know if you need help. Also, if you can put on your thinking caps, too. As a society, there are ways we can organize to fundraise to help the many tens of thousands of our fellow Queenslanders who have lost so much. Well, Scott, our thoughts are with the flooding victims in Australia, too. If you'd like to help, please email me, and I'll put you in touch with Scott directly. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you can also post comments or questions at the WhiskeyCast website. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go into the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. First off, there's a change in plans for the live taping this coming Saturday at the Victoria Whiskey Festival. We're actually going to try and pull off a live webcast from Victoria after all. You can listen in live around 2 p.m. Pacific Time, that's 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and 2200 GMT, and you'll need to go to the Victoria Whiskey Festival website to listen to the live webcast. That's Victoria Whiskey Festival, all one word, .com. We'll still be taping the show. It'll be available for downloading Saturday evening if you can't join us live. Other events coming up, Louisville's 21C Museum Hotel hosts the monthly Bourbon and the Girls Tasting on January 27th. The Linköping's Whiskey Expo is the weekend of February 11th and 12th in Linköping's, Sweden. And Whiskey Live Tokyo is February 19th and 20th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. Woodford Reserve marks two anniversaries next year in 2012. The 200th anniversary of distilling at what is now the Woodford Reserve Distillery in Versailles, Kentucky, and the 15th anniversary of Woodford Reserve itself. Dave Shurick is a big part of that history. He retired at the end of December as distillery manager at Woodford and was responsible for restoring the old LeBrow and Graham Distillery, which had been abandoned for more than two decades when Dave arrived.
The last time any operations had been performed there was in the 1960s. And Brown-Forman sold it in 1972 to a fellow named Freeman Hawkinsmith, who was going to make gas alcohol. If you remember, in 1972, there was an oil embargo, long lines at the gas station, and gas alcohol was the answer. And then in late 72, the embargo broke, and gas flowed freely again, and gas oil was too expensive to make. So for the next 23 years, the place just sat there with absolutely no maintenance. Those came through and broke out all the doors and windows, took anything of value, and burned down a couple buildings. And then Mother Nature came along and grew vines up all the buildings, and pulled the mortar out of the stonework, and rained through all the openings and rotted all the wood. So in 1994, that's what we saw when we looked at the place. It was in total disrepair.
And you pretty much moved on to the site at that time, right?
Well, let's see. January 2nd, 1995, myself and an engineer named Jens Lucan were assigned to come to the location and start developing plans for it.
And what was your background before that? Because you were not a distillery manager per se, right?
Well, I had been, my work history goes back to 1969 when I worked for Seagram for 15 years. And Seagram's had a penchant of moving its supervisors around, so I'd supervised in a distillery. I had like 12 different jobs in 15 years at Seagram, so they kind of did a good job of rounding its supervisors out. And then Seagram's closed the plant I was at, and I had an option to stay or go, and I decided to leave, and I went up to 7-Up in Detroit and was up there for a couple of years, and then came back down to Kentucky and worked for Wild Turkey for 3 years, and then moved over as a vice president of a box company, and then that's in 1989 I came to work for Brown-Forman as a facility maintenance and construction and security manager for the corporation. And then 5 years later is when I was introduced to what was then called the Brough & Graham Distillery. So it was an opportunity to be involved on the ground floor of creating a bourbon home place, a National Historic Landmark, and a premium bourbon all at the same time. To answer your question, I had some distillery background, but I was not a distillery manager per se when I moved into this job.
What did you think the first time you saw this place and you pulled up in Versailles and saw all those buildings and saw all the damage? What were you thinking?
Well, my boss at the time, I was working for a lady named Lois Matus, who was a senior vice president of Brown-Forman. And she took me out to get my opinion on what it would take to renovate the place. And my first impression is, oh, my God, what a run-down facility this was. But then you could also see the potential. It just had a certain air about it. And I was drawn to it. And Ms. Matus made a comment along the lines of, well, I told her what I thought it would take to renovate the place was the price of a bulldozer, because I thought it had gone so far past prime that it would take millions and millions to bring it back to life. And she said she intended to work on it. And I looked at her and I said, well, I'd like to, too. And she spun around and said, well, shine up your resume. And one thing led to another. I was allowed to be a project manager for the renovation and then stay on as the plant manager and general manager. But my first reaction was it had charisma. The tough thing was when I took my wife out there, because part of the arrangement was that I would be the plant manager and would live on property. Because all this was designed to be a throwback to the way bourbon was made in the old days, using cypress fermenters and copper pot stills, and the manager lived on property. So I brought my wife out and showed her the place. And you know, I said, honey, I'm going to work on this project, and we're going to live here. And it was a lot for her to accept, because we had a nice house in Louisville at the time.
What were her words, or can you repeat them?
Hold on a second. Hey, Della.
Yeah.
Come here for a minute. I'm going to put you on speaker. The question, are you there?
Yes.
I'm here.
What was when I took you out to Woodford Reserve or LeBron Graham for the first time, what were your words? Go ahead, say what.
It was a total mess the first time I saw it. But as the day we were looking around the property, the weeds were as tall as I am, and as we were going into the buildings, which were a total disrepair, they kept talking about, well, this is how it was going to look, and by the end of the day, I had a vision of what he was talking about, and I was thoroughly convinced it was going to look exactly how it looks today.
So you bought into this on the first day?
Yes.
It was a gigantic leap of faith on her part.
Yes.
Okay. I can imagine that this has been just as much fun for you as it was for him, Della.
Yes, well, it was. It was an exciting adventure. It truly was an adventure. When we went there, and you could see the buildings, the history was still there. It was hiding behind all the weeds and the vines that were growing through the windows and down the other side on the inside of the buildings, and the roofs weren't there and the windows weren't there. And we walked around to what used to be a beautiful distillery, and Dave kept talking about how this could look and how that could look, and I just began to see what he saw, and it looks just like what he said it was going to be.
Give you a for instance, Mark. First, have you been to Woodford?
I've been by there, yes.
Okay.
I haven't stopped. Well, hadn't had a chance to stop, but I've seen pictures of the place and been close up. I've been in the neighborhood. My plan is to get out there sometime this year and actually take a look around.
We almost tore down a building that's called the Old Dryer House, and that's where after distillation, the spent mash was dried so you could ship it distances to farmers for livestock feed. Typically, the dryer house is the worst part of a distillery. And this particular building, the first time I walked into it, a good-sized snake fell on top of me. The place had totally gone back to Mother Nature.
What did it take to bring it up to the standards it is today? I'm assuming it wasn't perfect when you finally started distilling a couple of years later, right?
Well, we spent over $10 million over almost 2 years to get the infrastructure put back together. And when we renovated, all the buildings had to be gutted except for one of the barrel warehouses. So we completely gutted all the buildings and retrofitted it with the equipment we have now.
What were you thinking on that day when the first spirit started running?
Oh, it was terrific. Part of the what we were going for was to distill using pot stills. Prior to Prohibition, most distilleries used pot stills. Pot stills are what you think of when you talk about people distilling back in the hollows of Kentucky. You know, they have a little vessel with a little curlicue coming out the top. A pot still is a batch distillation effort. And we literally had to go to Scotland to have it designed and built because during Prohibition, distillers weren't allowed to make whiskey, and they were frugal people. They converted their equipment to other things. So after 13 years of Prohibition, when it was repealed, the technology of the day had changed to a column still, which is a much more industrial-like process. So in order to retrofit with pot stills, we had to familiarize ourselves with pot stills. So we went over, we being myself and a couple of other design engineers, went over to Scotland and visited four or five Scottish distilleries to look at the size and shape of their stills. And interesting story, we went to Glenmorangie, who Brown-Forman had a relationship at the time. We distributed their scotches. And we measured the still, and we took drawings of it, and we asked the master distiller there, why are your pot stills shaped this way? And the response was, he huffed up and he says, because it gives our whiskey character. So we went to Glenfiddich, and Glenmorangie's pot stills are tall and narrow. Glenfiddich, their pot stills are sharp and squatty. and we measured their pot stills and asked them why they're shaped this way, and the response was, because it gives our whiskey character. And the next three distilleries we went to, we got the same response. So it told us that we had to decide what shape and height of diameter that we wanted these stills to be, because different styles of stills will give you different types of whiskey. So after we decided that, we ordered the stills, and then I had to go back over and learn how to run them, because nobody in the States knew how, which was an experience. And then once the stills were delivered, we were renovating all the buildings on site. We had the stills delivered to a sister plant in Louisville called Brown-Forman Distillery, and we actually set those stills up in one of the spare buildings there and ran mash through them so we could learn how to run them before we took them out and installed them at LeBrow and Graham.
Tell me about the experience of learning to run the stills over in Scotland.
Well, when you ask a question, you're going to get, sometimes you get long stories. Bear with me. At the time I went over, Brown-Forman also had a relationship with Bushmill. And Bushmill's an Irish whiskey, and most Irish whiskeys are triple distilled. That's another thing we decided to do, was to make our whiskey using pot stills and make it using the triple distillation method. Now, it's not done by very many people. There are only five distilleries that I know of that makes whiskey using triple distillation. Three of those distilleries are in Ireland, and one of them is in Scotland. The one in Scotland is called Auchentoshan. It's in Glasgow. So I was scheduled to go to Bushmill to learn how to run triple distillation and pot stills. And the week I flew over, Bushmill had a problem, so the fellow that built the stills for us, his name's Richard Forsyth, he lives in Rothes, Scotland, he arranged for me to go to Auchentoshan. And he actually drove me to Auchentoshan, which was a 4 to 5 hour drive. And I'd been in Scotland for about a week, and I was sort of tired, and the drive was a long one. And when we got to the distillery, I was introduced to the plant manager of Auchentoshan, who introduced me to, by that time it was about 6 o'clock at night, he introduced me to his night shift operator. Well, I took my pencil and my notepad, and I'm eager to take information down. And the fellow that was running the stills on that shift was as Cockney-speaking a Scotsman as I've ever heard. And I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And I saw my career going down the drain, because everything he was telling me, I just couldn't make out. So that night, I went home and got a good night's sleep, went to the hotel. And the next morning, I was introduced to the day shift operator. And I had, my ears were more accustomed, and he was more understandable. And I got the information I needed from him, and then when the second shift fella came in, I actually could understand what he was telling me as well. So our system is copied quite a bit from the Auchentoshan system. They were very open to us, and it's been a good relationship. I still see the vice president of Baltimore, which owns Auchentoshan. We still are good friends.
This is probably a good time to clarify a question that comes up about Woodford from time to time. Does the distillery out in Versailles, the old LeBrow and Graham plant, produce all of the distillate for Woodford, or is there a mix between some of that distillate and some of the distillate from the Brown-Forman distillery in Louisville?
Yeah, here's the story on behind that one. In we opened October 17, 1996. And Woodford Reserve, the brand, was, we began shipping and marketing Woodford in 1996. And Woodford is 6.5 to 7 years old. So you don't have to be much of a mathematician to figure that the whiskey came from somewhere else at the beginning. Prior to the project, Brown-Forman decided to start making whiskey and laying it away at a sister plant in Louisville. And in 1996, what went into Woodford Reserve was from that sister plant. So what we started making in 1996 at Woodford Reserve was made using the same yeast and the same mash bill as the whiskey that was produced for us from Brown-Forman Distillery. Now, the original model said that as the pot still whiskey aged, that eventually we would phase in the pot still whiskey and phase out the whiskey from Louisville. However, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. Back in about 2001, the whiskey was 4.5 to 5 years old, and we noticed that there was a little bit of difference between the current Woodford Reserve at the time and the pot still whiskey that was being aged. And that difference, it was very, very similar, except that the pot still whiskey had a little bit of nuttiness to it. It had some almonds back in the background. And we were concerned that if we arbitrarily phased in the pot still whiskey and phased out the whiskey from Louisville, that we may find, at the time, Woodford was taking off like a rocket and was getting great reviews and lots of press. And we were concerned that we would be caught in a cult classic situation where people would notice that there was a difference. And we just didn't want to take that risk. So we decided to continue using the whiskey from Louisville and marriage it with the whiskey from Woodford. And that's what we're doing today. Now, if you took the whiskey from 1996 and today's whiskey, today's Woodford, and sampled them side by side, if you're really good, you'll find that nuttiness in the background. But it was a way to stay true to the original flavor.
That was something I was curious about. I was going to ask what the difference was in the character between the two sets of stills, because we know that column stills produce one set of flavors and pot stills produce a completely different set altogether. And I was going to ask how you managed to balance those out.
Yeah, and there's also something else that goes on here, too. Every distillery has a biological system of its own that will have a tendency to flavor the whiskey in the fermenter. I talked to some of my colleagues from Seagram, and they said in the 60s or 70s, Seagram's tried to produce the exact same whiskey at two plants, and they were using everything the same except for the water. They use the same yeast, the same mash bill, the same type fermenters, column stills to distill it, the same barrels, and they couldn't make the same whiskey. So when we're using open-top cypress fermenters, wooden fermenters, and the distillery in Louisville is using stainless steel fermenters, that creates a little bit of an ambiguity in flavors.
So the plan is to keep it this way from now on, right?
Yes. Now, competitors came out and said, well, that's because they're not making good whiskey at Woodford Reserve. And we, if you go out and you try to argue that point, it just sounds like you're trying to throw up a defense. But eventually we started making a whiskey called Master's Collection. And I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh,
or not.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, those are all whiskeys that were made at Woodford Reserve. They're all, the base of those whiskeys is all 100% triple pot still. And the liberating factor here is that when I think Four Grain came out, it won an international spirits competition gold. And then a few years later, Sweet Mash came out and did the same thing. So it was nice to be able to say, yeah, we are making excellent bourbon from these pot stills.
Over the last 15 years or so, you've been running the plant on a day-to-day basis. First with Lincoln Henderson as the master distiller, and then more recently with Chris Morris. Tell me about working with these guys, starting off with Lincoln. What was it like working with him?
Well, Lincoln was well established. I think I can't tell you how many years he spent with Brown-Forman, but he was very knowledgeable, and he worked in research and development. And he was given the direction to create the Woodford Reserve flavor, and make sure that the whiskeys that were being produced at the Brown-Forman distillery in Louisville were the best whiskeys possible. So he did that, and he literally put these whiskeys together and put it in a bottle, and took a picture of the grist millstone that's embedded in the stonework above the entrance door to the distillery. And he used that as a label to put on the bottle to present to the executive committee, in trying to convince the executive committee to sanction the project and the creation of Woodford Reserve. So Lincoln was very, he was one of the key people here that developed the whiskey, and then he was also used to, he was the face of Woodford Reserve, and he went out and did a lot of brand ambassador type promotions and presentations, as did the original general manager, Bill Creason, and myself. In the early days, it was all missionary work. And what was truly amazing was that when Woodford came out, it received immediate acclamations, and we grew faster than we had anticipated, because as the original concept was that we were going to be in five states, Kentucky and some of the surrounding states, and then that we would introduce Woodford into three or four states year after year. But we became so successful so fast that it was decided to market in all 50 states in the second and third year. And we successfully did that. It was a dangerous thing to do. Because if, let's take California, for instance, if you market in California, but you don't have the wherewithal to support the product that you're promoting, and it dies on the shelf, well, a few years later, when you're truly ready to do that, if the retailers already had a problem years before, they're not going to take a risk to do it again. And the amazing thing is that Woodford just took root wherever it went. So it was a good decision to do that, but it was a risk.
If you had one thing to do all over, what would you do differently?
Nothing. Nobody's ever asked me that question, and I'm From the very get-go, it's always just been the most wonderful experience and adventure I've ever been on. I wouldn't change a thing.
What are you going to do these days? I know you were planning on doing some traveling, but I hear tell you're also going to stick around a little bit and help promote the brand for a certain amount of time, right?
Yeah, I like action, and it's nice to have some freedom to travel. My wife and I are still very much having fun with each other, and we're going to do a lot of traveling, but I also still have a soft spot in my heart for Woodford Reserve, and I talked to Wayne Rose, the brand manager, and we've come to an agreement that when they needed me, I could be a resource, a brand ambassador for whatever function they needed me to do. So I keep my finger on the pulse there. Someday I want to teach in college. I've just got lots of odds and ends and interests, so I don't plan on being bored in my afterlife.
Now, you mentioned that you've lived on the site since about 94, 95, 96 time frame. Tell me what you were thinking as you moved out.
Well, that was probably one of the toughest things, because we moved out. First of all, I decided to retire December 31st of 2010, and my wife and I debated on whether we wanted to move out before or after the holidays. I had the flexibility to move out in January if, I was leaving under the best of circumstances, but we decided that it would be better to move the first week in November, so we could be settled over the holidays. And the tough part of it all was preparing the house we moved into as I was... Well, let me take a step back, Mark. When we moved in to Woodford Reserve, it was great. Living where you work and working where you live is a two-edged sword. And because I was the only person with responsibility at the time, I felt obligated for us to stay there on weekends. It was just a security thing. After a couple of years, I talked to my boss, and I just told him, I said, it's not a healthy thing for us to feel locked down all the time. So we moved another employee on property, and my wife and I decided to buy a house on Harrington Lake in Danville. Well, the house we ended up buying was on an acre and a quarter overlooking the lake, but it was a makeover house. So we renovated it, and then once we renovated it, we thought, boy, we're on it. This is a great piece of property. So we added on to the house. And then we added on some more, so that when it was time for us to move, we had to prepare the house here, so that we could combine two houses into one, all the furniture. So one of the biggest concerns was how were we going to do that without losing our minds. The retirement itself was. It was bittersweet. I've got the best staff in the world, and I will dearly miss them. But we're also, like I said, we're looking forward to having some freedom. I've always been in harness since the day I started first grade, and it's been kind of nice having time to myself. So you brought up, you asked a question about Lincoln, and then you mentioned Chris.
Yeah,
it was interesting to watch Lincoln. You know, he created the product in the process, and he and I were learned how to run these pot stills out at the Brown-Forman Distillery. It's also called Early Times Distillery, but the name's changed to Brown-Forman. But it was great working with Lincoln. And then when he decided to retire, he trained Chris to become the Carpet Master Distiller, and Chris, Chris's forte is he's an astute historian, and in our business, history really matters because we have such great, interesting, off the wall characters and stories, and Chris really does a good job with that, and positioning the brand and supporting it, and representing it. So we've been fortunate to have two people representing Woodford Reserve that are very professional in what they do.
What do you miss most now that you're not there on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I miss the staff, number one. Number two, there was always some action going on. You know, we're always talking about the next Derby bottle. We also bottled Old Forester Birthday Bourbon, which is part of Brown-Forman's portfolio. We bottled something called Collingwood, which is a premium Canadian whiskey. And the reason we did these extracurricular things is because our bottling line is the oldest, newest, slowest, smallest bottling line in the country, probably. We run a speed of 50 bottles a minute. And we are astute at doing a lot of hand labeling and operations. So there was always something going on in the personal selection, the master's collection. In the distillery, we were running different types of whiskeys in preparation for master's collections out into time. So all those nuances I miss.
You miss the smell?
I do. I went by a distillery yesterday, and the wind was blowing in the right direction, and it immediately took me back to Woodford. When you walk in your distillery, people will ask me, well, how do you know things are going right? How do you manage the quality of your distillery? And my response is, all I have to do is walk into the distillery area and take one smell, and you'll know whether things are right or wrong just by that first sensation.
Because I know that that sweet corn smell that hits you about a mile downwind from the distillery or so, and you know you're getting close to something good.
It does, and if you're doing all your processes and procedures correctly, and you make good bourbon, which we do, you get used to that sweet, pungent smell. If your yeast and you have bacteria around you all the time, if your fermentation takes the wrong turn, you know it immediately. It's only happened once in 15 years, and we immediately caught it and made a correction. But it's amazing how quickly you can tell when something's not right.
Now, Lincoln retired, but didn't really retire. He's now got his own bourbon out there. Are you retired for good, or might we see you make a comeback a few years down the road?
Well, the interesting thing here is that it's hard to say this without sounding. I think I've developed a lot of good relationships with a number of people that are talented, and there have been phone calls asking my opinion on things. So I don't think I'll ever get bourbon out of my blood, so to speak. It's an industry that it has mystique and charisma and history and it's something I've been very proud to be a part of, and I want to stay a part of it in some form, shape, or fashion. Whether I make my own whiskey or not, I don't think so. But whether I give people encouragement or direction of some sort, if they ask me, I'll give them my best shot.
I was looking through all of my tasting notes after talking with Dave, and while I've done notes for most of the Master's Collection releases, turns out I'd never done tasting notes on the flagship Woodford Reserve bourbon, so let's solve that little problem and start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with Woodford Reserve. It's bottled at 45.2% ABV, 90.4 proof. The nose has notes of vanilla, almonds, nutmeg, and caramel. The taste is smooth with a subtle touch of cinnamon and notes of brown sugar, caramel, and almonds, and the finish is light with touches of vanilla, dark chocolate, and almonds. I'm scoring Woodford Reserve an 86. I celebrated a birthday the other night with a dram of the Glenrothes 1979 single cask bottling. Sherry Butt number 3808 was bottled at 55.2% ABV. The nose has notes of vanilla, plums, dates, and toasted oak. The taste is spicy and thick with Christmas cake, orange peel, plums, raisins, and brown sugar. The finish is long and sweet with rich tropical fruit notes and a touch of brown sugar to boot. I'm scoring the Glenrothes 1979 single cask a 92. Of course, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android, and at the WhiskeyCast website, too. That's also where you'll find the calendar of events, links to my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. Don't forget about the live webcast this coming Saturday from the Victoria Whiskey Festival at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. East Coast Time, and 2200 GMT. You can listen in live at victoriawhiskeyfestival.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.